Randy Nguyen's trying to plead with the president to take some pity on the working class. This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And I do believe that Uma De Consumer, or is it De Consumer?
It's De Consumer.
Yes, I should get that right. Has brought with her
maybe
also
your whole accent's changing. Why is this
I
happening?
Know,
what's
it's
going on here?
So perverse. Well, I believe she's brought with her an advertisement that gives some of her sensitivity to the outfit that she's wearing. And we're going to hear that now.
Billionaires for both.
Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
When human rights groups discover that our third world sweatshops employ a lot of child labor, they're always horrified. These children should be in school, they stridently insist. But why would these kids be better off sitting at a desk learning about social studies than working on our assembly lines? Schools are supposed to prepare you for the future. In most of the places we do business, the only future these moppets have is on an assembly line. What better way for them to prepare than in our sweatshop apprentice program? The kids get paid a special introductory wage while they learn all the skills they'll need for the rest of their short, miserable lives. And those little hands can do some really intricate stitching, believe me. This has been Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here come the billionaires!
Well.
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 Well said, I said.
Well, we're going to find out what Michael Zweig, professor of economics and director of the Study of Working Class Life at Stony Brook and author of What's Class Got to Do with It? And Thomas Frank, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America? And Dorothy Sue Cobble, The Other Woman's Movement. Think about that, what I'm sorry to say, repugnant piece of propaganda that WBAI was forced to put on by billionaires for Bush, who seem to have commandeered our station this evening. Well, with that, Thomas Frank, Michael Zweig, Dorothy Sue Cobble, good evening and welcome to our special programming.
Thank you.
How repulsive was that? But the fact of the matter is, what has class got to do with it? How are we to understand class? Is that even an obsolete concept, Michael Zweig?
Well, I think that the class is very much in our lives and very much in our face these days. And so much of the talk about rich and poor is really, I think, better understood as a discussion of the relationship between workers and the working class on the one hand and capitalists on the other. Even the question of poverty in the last segment that you had on the show here, there was an idea perhaps conveyed that poverty is something that happens to blacks, Hispanics, and some marginal other at the bottom of society. Really, three-quarters of all poor people in this country are white. Three-quarters of all black people in this country are not poor. Poverty is really something that happens to working people because of low wages, because of bad conditions, because of bad health care. And I think that the sooner that we understand that we're involved really in a class warfare in this country and working people can mobilize on that basis, we'll have a better chance of confronting what's really coming down. Certainly the people who run a country understand very well that they're involved in class warfare. That's one reason why they raise it in order to defeat it.
Thomas Frank, you talk about class also in your book, What's the Matter of Kansas, but you talk about working class people seeing liberals as being the enemy. Why is that?
There's been a campaign now for over 30 years to persuade working class people that that's the case. This morning I was reading a copy of National Review, the conservative magazine that William F. Buckley edits or used to edit or whatever.
Unfortunately.
And I was reading an ad for the Conservative Book Club, okay, and it had little capsule descriptions of all these different books that you could buy for cheap from them. And three or four of them were denunciations of the elite. This is a stock in trade in conservative circles. You can turn on your AM radio any time of the day, anywhere in America, and hear a right-winger denouncing the elite. There's a whole network, on cable TV, a whole news network, Fox News, dedicated to assailing the elite. They talk about it all the time. And in some ways, the whole idea of a liberal elite, you know, which is a, it's propaganda and it's a hallucination and it's not entirely true. What's really interesting about it, though, is that it's a way of talking about things that, they attribute the same things to this liberal elite that our ancestors would have attributed to the corporate elite or to capitalists, you know, to be blunt about it. They just shift the language a little. So instead of William Randolph Hearst twisting the news, it's liberal elitists like you and me. Or you know, instead of, you know, Harvard teaching people how to be good capitalists and they have a finishing school for the upper classes, instead it's this nest of liberalism, right, that hates America, that sort of thing.
And Dorothy Sue Cobble, what of women? Where do they fit into this picture? Where do they position themselves on the class strata?
Well, one of the things that I've written about in the other women's movement is actually how there was a long tradition of working class feminism or labor feminism. And I think that when you look back historically at women, it's really important to understand that some of the first working women were working class women, the pioneers of sort of the working women of today, and the kind of agenda that they created is one that I think we're returning to, which I would argue is an agenda for the majority of women and not just the few.
I want to go back to Thomas Frank. First of all, I you know, had a delight, spent the whole day today actually finishing What's the Matter with Kansas, How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. And I was miserable by it. It's very funny. It's wonderfully written, but you really depressed the hell out of me.
I apologize for that. I'm just this natural.
I don't believe you. I don't believe you. But
you don't think I'm a pessimist?
I think you're a pessimist. I don't believe
everything
that.
I said is coming true. Kerry is going down. Did you see the papers? He's brought in Clinton's people to.
Yeah, that was no source of great encouragement for me. But one of the things that is elaborated on in the book is, yeah, great agrarian reform, the heartland of the country, a hotbed of labor sentiment and organizing and activity,
yeah.
And what in the
100
world
years ago, yeah.
Makes people betray their class interests?
And you know what's funny is when the book first came out, this was in May and in June, it was a Harper's Magazine cover story, and this made people so mad, and I was getting phone calls. How can it, it's not possible for people to vote against their class interests. People were made very angry by this argument, and then I saw in the New York Times a story about this, and they're reporting it very matter-of-factly. They go to a manufacturing county in Ohio that's, you know, has strong interests with the, you know, with good wages and with all, you know, all your working class issues are, you know, when working class people do well, this county does well. And yet these people are going for Bush by a healthy majority. West Virginia, you just don't get more working class than West Virginia. And they went for Bush last time, and, you know, by 6 points, and they're going to do it again, or they are, it looks like they are right now. That's, something is going deeply wrong when Bush is able to speak to working class people and John Kerry is not. That's, and we shouldn't just say it's not just the voters' fault. It's the fault of the Democratic Party as well.
Well, I think we see this inversion, like the way that Tom Frank, you talk about the elite is now all of a sudden the enemy. It's like this, as spoken by the elites. It's like all of a sudden Bush is the great warrior and Kerry is the punk.
Yeah.
You know, these people have an amazing capacity to twist everything and turn it upside down. I think that one way that we have to go back to turn this around is to come back to these questions of values and whether the litmus test of good and proper values is who do you sleep with, or is it why is there poverty and why is there oppression?
Exactly.
These
whenever,
questions
whenever
of
the
economic
candidate...
justice are issues that had been the hallmark of the Democratic Party, the hallmark of the of worker struggle, and over the last 30 years, a part of the attack on the living conditions of working people, the material attack, has also been this other piece of it, which is kind of to change the subject about what's right and wrong, what's just and unjust, and I think that we need to address those questions just exactly in those class terms.
I think that's exactly right. Whenever you hear people talking about values, they're basically, you know, we should decide the election on values. They're basically saying we should decide the election on nothing. We should decide it on, like, what kind of person the candidate is rather than any hard, you know, any real material issues. And oddly enough, the Democrats seem quite willing to play along with that way of thinking about politics. Very disheartening.
It does strike me, however, that in some ways working people have a better voting record than the middle class and the upper middle class, and that part of the problem is that people at the bottom don't vote. And I think there's a sort of odd way in which if the question is why don't working people vote their economic interests, you're sort of letting the elite off the hook. Historically, working people have supported the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Women still do, blacks still do, union members still do. And I think one of the challenges is to get out that base rather than to blame those people for somehow not voting the way they should vote.
Yeah, that's totally true. And I'll tell you, the thing about politics of culture wars, you know, when your politics gets defined as culture war rather than as, well, class war or a struggle over material interests, it tends to turn off voters at the bottom, and it tends to remove a lot of the issues from the table that would have ordinarily have motivated them. And it tends to, you know, give you this distorted picture. By the way, I don't think there's anything wrong with rich people voting Republican. I think that's what they ought to be doing. that's their role. That's their job. And, yeah, of course, working class people are better Democrats than...
If I could add a billionaire perspective and another dynamic to this, it's all about marketing. George Bush, as we've seen, has been marketed as the common man. He doesn't represent the common man. We all know he's in billionaires' pockets, but it's all marketing. And in the 80s, we succeeded in the marketing of the welfare mother and Willie Horton, and that really scared and threw a lot of working class into the Republicans' corner. And now we have terrorism, and nothing like fear. Fear works nothing better than to get people to vote our way than fear. In the 80s, we had welfare moms, we had Willie Horton, but terrorism practically sells itself, and people are scared, and they want to wrap themselves in the flag, and they want to vote to the man who wraps himself in the bigger flag. And we've done that really effectively these last 3 years in putting Bush on this pedestal of being the working man president. And it's all marketing, and people buy it. They buy Paris Hilton, they buy Walmart cheap goods, and they buy this president. We've done a brilliant job, this billionaire.
Didn't his dad once visit a flag factory?
I'm sure he did.
Remember the election of 88? It was fought over the Pledge of Allegiance.
That's right. That's right. Karl Rove is our man, and he does push him in the right direction.
Well, you know, I think that we should come back to the point that Sue Cobble just made, that working people do vote more in their interest than sometimes we tend to give them credit for. I think that the idea that working people are somehow stupid and the enemy and the problem in this scene, I think is not right. I think that there is in the voting record and in the daily life of working people a sense of mutuality and mutual responsibility and concern that does get reflected in how they vote, and also gets reflected on how they live and the kind of values that people have in their lives of mutual concern, values of community support that challenge the raw and stark individualism that the real elites want to encourage. And I think that those kinds of values and values of justice and fairness need to be things that we come back and touch and mobilize around. You have a situation where just in the last 3 years, household income in the United States has gone down by over 3%. That's not just individual, but the whole household. People now are making in real dollars less than they were making, considerably less than they were making 3 years ago, yet workers are more productive. There's more output per worker substantially than there was 3 years ago. Well, so people are making more, but they're getting less, so where is it going? Where is it going, the work? It's going to the billionaires that are sitting next to me here and stinking up the room with their with their smoke and their ideas. And I think that what we need to do is to really address in a very concrete way the unfairness and the illegitimacy of that great grab into a grab of what working people produce into the pockets of the very rich and the top elites and corporate rulers in this country. I think
we
need to do that.
No bid contracts.
Well, I'm sure you do, but we're going to have to do something about it.
I think if the Democrats started talking the way you're talking now, I think it would be a great success for them. It's very irritating to me, their absolute refusal to talk about the larger issues of the direction our economy is heading, not just, you know, how it's been doing for the last 6 months or the last 2 years, but how it's been doing for the last 30 years and how we have totally reworked it to favor these billionaires and to make it so that all the gains from productivity advances go into the pockets of shareholders. That would be a devastating issue if Democrats started going around to these towns in Ohio and West Virginia and, you know, pointing out what's happened to people's lives, what's happened to the world that we live in the last 20 years, you know, where has it gone?
Yes, billionaires for Bush have been trying to do that.
I think there's definitely a class resentment that can be tapped into. But I guess I feel similarly to the way one of my favorite labor leaders, Chris Rondeau, who heads up the Harvard Union of Clerical and Technical Workers, is that you can't just build a social movement on anger. And I think you need to have a message that appeals to people's better selves, that says to them this is a way forward in terms of your own opportunity, in terms of your own aspirations and dreams. And I don't think that you're going to build a movement just on class resentment and anger.
Well, billionaires for Bush are traveling all over the country trying to remind voters just how good it's been for us, and we're working hard doing it. And if people want to help us do that, they can at billionairesforbush.com. There are 76 of our chapters. But I agree with all of you that it has been so good for us. I just don't know why people are so angry about it.
You know what's funny, though, is the real anger out there, it's not really at billionaires. I mean, sure, there's, you know, people like friends of mine in the South Side of Chicago are angry at billionaires. But if you turn on the sort of the official anger channel, you know, Fox News, which is always irate, you know, always indignant.
Right beneath the surface of everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but there is anger in people's lives when they are losing their jobs, when they have to work harder, when they do work longer and they get less for it. People are angry. And then there's just a question of where does that anger get directed and how does it get transformed into a constructive politics? And there I think these questions of class do come in and help, particularly when issues of race and gender come into the picture. Because what we've seen in the last 30 years and what we saw, for example, with welfare reform in the 1990s was a very deliberate attempt to deflect the anger of working people away from those who were running the country and running people's lives into the ground and making instead the scapegoats, the welfare queens and women and minorities who were just cheating on welfare and getting
rich on
affirmative
action. But isn't
it
ironic that the one successful Democrat we've had since Johnson, Clinton, actually stole some of those Republican themes and built a coalition that in part was based on ending welfare as we know.
Yeah, well, that's quite ironic and quite destructive of the interests of working people and the interests of women and minorities in this country.
But he also wasn't his. I would challenge the Clinton's success is not that clear cut. He won in '92 because of Ross Perot. If Ross Perot hadn't been in the race, there's no way Clinton would have won. And remember his victory for decades. The Democratic Leadership Council, and he came out of that part of the Democratic Party. Remember, have been promising to elect a Democratic president. They would elect a Democratic president. They would, you know, hold nothing back to get that deed done. Well, they got it. They got him elected. What's the first thing that happens? They lose both houses of Congress, and they continue to lose them. The Republicans still hold them 10 years later. They haven't had that since the 1920s. And, you know, today they're the minority party in both houses, and it's not a record to be proud of, in my opinion. I've moved here to D.C. recently, and the Democrats constantly point to Clinton as this great success story, but it just isn't the case.
Well, it certainly wasn't the case for working people, because you had a decline in union strength, you had a growth in the inequality in this country, you had a big boom, But that boom went mainly to the benefit of the very wealthy and to the owners of capital. And it wasn't until the very late 1990s, just for about 2.5 or 3 years, that the labor market got tight enough so that working people experienced an actual increase in their standard of living. It was really quite a remarkable record of achievement for the quite conservative agenda, as you say, of the DLC.
Thomas Frank, the Democratic Party, it seems to me, has been pulling away from its labor base of 30 years ago, since Kennedy. Does this have to do with strategy? I mean, why is this? Does it have to do with strategy, or does it have to do with the fact that they're beholden to the rich also?
Well, they're becoming more beholden. I wonder about this all the time. You know, this is a theme in the book, that the Democrats are just as much to blame for this, for the disaster that has befallen them and that has befallen working class people, as are the Republicans. And there's several different reasons. The main one that you keep coming back to, though, is money. When you talk to official Democrats here in Washington, the word that always comes to their lips, when I start telling them about, you know, what about working class issues, what about this, what about that, what about inequality, what about the way that profits are shared, and they say, all that's very interesting, but we can't talk about that. We have to be safe. The party has to be safe. We have to be safe for corporate contributions, and we have to be safe for the suburban swing voters who always use the term suburban professionals. That's the segment of the electorate that they're most concerned about winning over. And basically what it seems to me is that they are very much interested in becoming precisely the sort of liberal elite that Republicans mock them for being already. That's what they at the highest levels, that's their grand strategy, is to become the other pro-business party. So they're going to be the party of, like, the sensitive businessman who believes in evolution, you know, and who doesn't want to pull the rug out from under public schools, while the other Republicans will be the party of the sort of coarse businessman who has bad manners and doesn't speak French or whatever the hell it is. It's maddening, but you can at least see the logic for it when they start talking about the TV commercials. Is all elections now are decided, everybody knows this, if you don't run TV commercials, you're done for. And those are very expensive, and there's no way labor can pony up to the degree that business can. It's not an equal competition.
But naturally, one of the things labor is doing that is really important is the focus on turning out the vote. And I think there was something in the Philadelphia Inquirer about the impact that unions have had in terms of a greater and greater proportion of those voting are actually what they call labor family households. And union members or labor family households do tend to vote more progressively. And I think one of the issues is not just sort of trying to think of what's happened to the working class, but to try to understand that there are many different working classes, and there's a new working class since the 1970s and 1980s that looks very different and has different needs than the industrial working class of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And I think the Democratic Party and the left really needs to think about the multiplicity of class experience and how that can be addressed.
I think that this point that Sue has just made, I think, is very important, that when we talk about class, we aren't just talking about a single experience. All workers are the working class and they have the same experience, or for that matter, all capitalists or all of the middle class. There are differences of experience if you're a worker and you're white or black, or if you're a man or a woman, or if you're in one part of the country or another, industrial or a white-collar a worker in a service industry. These are all different experiences that we have to understand and appreciate how they connect to one another and how they also provide the basis for division and differences, which is one reason why we now have just recently formed a Working Class Studies Association, just as we have Black Studies and we have Women's Studies. Now we have Working Class Studies, and people can check out these issues of class a little bit more through the Working Class Studies Association. I invite people to come, if I could, to a website. www.workingclass.sunysb, that's sunysb.edu, which is the website of the Center for Study of Working Class Life at Stony Brook. And we also have there information about this Working Class Studies Association. And in the book that I just have edited, What's Class Got to Do with It, there is a section on the mosaic of class, race, and gender, and Sue Koppel has a piece in there, When Feminism Had Class, and Bill Fletcher has a piece in there also, and Jeff Lustig, on this exactly this question of the multiple experiences of the working class depending on race and gender, but also the different experiences of race depending on what class people are in, and also the different experiences of gender and the women's movement also divided by class. Those are all kind of complicated dynamics that we really have to look at, and look at in the context of the social movements of working people, so that we aren't just left with the electoral politics in the equation, but also what does it take to get unions to be organized more effectively? What does it take to get more workers in different forms of organization, new immigrant rights and immigrant worker organizations and so on? Those are issues that we really need to pay attention to, both as a practical organizing matter and also just intellectually, just to understand how the society works when we look at it through this lens of class.
And let me just tell you, if you just tuned in, this is Building Bridges. We're speaking with Michael Zweig, professor of economics and director of the study of working class life at Stony Brook.
The Center for Study of Working Class.
Center for Study. And Dorothy Sue Koppel, the other woman's movement. And Thomas Frank, best-selling author of What's the Matter with Kansas? What I'd like to just throw into the pot and stir around is perhaps what's the matter with Kansas is what's the matter with a great deal of the working class, and that has to do with its cultural backwardness, that this is a culture and this is an economy that has been nurtured by xenophobia, by virulent racism since the founding of this country. And to what degree does a conjuncture of race and class really continue to mute the collective interests of the working class so they can buy that snake oil salesmanship of the Republican Party? Thomas Frank?
I'm probably not the best one to answer this, although the way you phrased the question really set me up for it, but I'm sorry to disappoint you. Because in the book, great movement to the right in the U.S. since the 60s, and a lot of which has been accomplished with the votes of working class people, which, you know, used to always go to the Democrats, and today goes, you know, has gone ever since the late 60s to various right-wing candidates. Not all working-class people, of course, just some. And there has always a heavy dollop of racism in this movement, in the backlash movement. I mean, for Pete's sake, it started with George Wallace, right, in the late 60s. And you remember that the UAW went way out of their way to contain the Wallace phenomenon, and they actually did that pretty well. But in the book that I wrote, What's the Matter with Kansas, I don't talk about the subject of race all that much because, interestingly enough, it almost never comes up in the conservative discourse in Kansas. They're far angrier about all the other sort of hot-button backlash issues, whether it's abortion or whether it's school prayer or whether it's gun control or whether it's what's the crazy new one? Gay marriage, you know, or evolution, for Pete's sake. These things really get people riled there, but when something like the affirmative action decision came down last year, nobody said anything. This didn't make anybody that I was in contact with didn't make them mad at all. That was not a big point for them. So that, I'm not the best one to talk about that, but it's, as I said, the whole history of the movement is of this right-wing movement is littered with ugly racial episodes, and I'm hoping some of the other guests can talk about that some more.
Well, I think that before we get too far down the road of just looking only at working class racism, which certainly exists, I ask you to think about Trent Lott. And I'd ask you to think about Strom Thurmond and other people, you know, who are in the true corporate political elites who are pushing a racist agenda and who often do so openly, but more recently perhaps are a little bit more sophisticated and clever about it. But racism is something that very definitely operates, and so does sexism and male chauvinism in this country, and it's very debilitating. There's no doubt about that. And at the same time, I think that within the working class people, there is a basis to address that, and there is a long history also of organizing in multiracial and across gender lines. And I think that we do have to address this question, as you know, Mimi put it, of cultural backwardness, but I wouldn't want to just attribute that cultural backwardness to working people.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the issues that comes up for me is, you know, it seems like there's definitely cultural differences, whether we're thinking about urban areas versus rural, or the blue states and the red states. And, you know, first of all, it seems like the centers for progressivism and for support of the Democratic Party have often been urban centers and industrial centers where, you know, there's a large proportion of working class people. But one of the things that came up in the other women's movement when I was doing my research, and in fact part of what prompted the book, was to address this question which seemed to hover over a lot of scholarship on the history of the women's movement, which was, why were working class women so conservative? Why didn't they support the things that the middle and upper class women and the college educated women knew were the right things to support? And it turned out that the more I sort of began to peel the layers off the onion and really began to look at what was going on, is that there had been a very powerful cross-class women's movement right into the 1960s and 70s. And I think a lot of the second wave feminist movement was organized around what I would think of and what many working class women considered to be a romanticization of market work, and a belief that if you could move into men's jobs and organize your life around a career, then that's what should be the ideal. And in fact, many working class women were, I think, rightly skeptical of organizing their lives around jobs that, in fact, you know, factory jobs. They didn't see housework, for example, as something they wanted to escape. And because of these differences, differences that largely grew out of their own economic realities, they were often seen as conservative and not supportive of the women's movement, when in fact they had a very different notion of what the women's movement should be. And some of these issues we're coming back to now. Their emphasis was on wage discrimination and transforming women's low-wage work, making pink-collar jobs better jobs rather than shifting women into men's jobs. They wanted work to transform to accommodate women. They were sort of on the forefront of this issue of how to balance work and family.
Well, I think when we talk about these relationships of race and class and gender, just as Sue just did, I think in a very important way, looking at what different pieces of the women's movement addressed different issues and thought different things were important depending upon who they were. It wasn't enough just to know that someone was a woman. You have to know what are their interests in other ways. And I think that as we look at the existence and the life of working class, what we're going to find is that it has different interests that are expressed within different segments of it. So working class women may have a different view of what the women's movement should be doing and even than professional women. And working class women may have a different understanding of what the women's of what the labor movement should be doing than working class men who are working right next to them. Because, again, there are differences. At the same time, those differences don't mean that there is no such thing as a working class that has also common interests that bridge across race and gender. And I think that we need to look not only in the political arena, as I was saying before, but in the actual organizing efforts that people are doing at work and in the communities to address interests that working people have, not just to look at those social movements for their material content, what are the actual demands, but also to really look at the values and the ethics that underlie those movements that make those claims for fairness and for equality and what makes those claims legitimate in our society. And those questions of what is a legitimate claim and how should the world be organized, those are all things that a workers' movement needs to raise and that the women's movement and that the civil rights movements also need to address, not only in racial and gender terms, but also in class terms. And we see that in a number of different ways, and Sue has talked about them in a certain kind of a way. You see that with U.S. Labor Against the War, which is an organization of working people, white, black, men, women, who are looking at the question of peace and war, and particularly now the war in Iraq, for what is it, you know, what's legitimate and what's illegitimate, what are the values, what are the ethics, what are the moralities that should be governing American foreign policy, and see in that debate something that working people have in common and that working people need to address as a political and as a social force in this country. And it's happening. You know, we can be depressed and we can be agitated about how tough the situation is, but there are some things that are going in the country that working people are doing that are pretty good and pretty important.
I mean, I think one of the powerful things about Fahrenheit 9/11 actually is that it's a populist film, but populism from the left. And as somebody who grew up working class, I was really happy to see a film that was both very critical of our policy in Iraq, but at the same time very sympathetic to the people who were soldiers and who were fighting that war, trying to understand how they ended up where they are.
Well, you know, there was a very interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal maybe 6 weeks ago just about that point, that in Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is the home of Fort Bragg, Fahrenheit 9/11 was playing on three screens, 11 shows a day, and it was sold out. It was sold out every day, and Marines were coming up from Camp Lejeune in South Carolina. They're driving 2.5 hours, and they were there because they wanted to see other soldiers talking about their own experiences. They wanted to see their communities where they had come from represented in the actual debate and discussion about the war. And I think that there we have a lesson that if you have a conversation, a national and public conversation, in which working people actually participate and their voices are actually there, I think we can have a much more progressive and a much more lively conversation than if all we have are some groomed individuals who are there trying to get over for purposes of a particular election one day, and then the day is over, and then that grooming turns out to have a different agenda.
I want to go back to Kansas. you can't go home again, but I'm trying. Thomas Frank, how did the conservatives really win the heart of America? I continue to be incensed at what has happened in the heartland, in the Midwest. I am certainly versed in its progressive movements. What happened? How are we to understand, again, that subversion, that hallucinogenic kind of subversion of the class sensitivity?
Yeah. And I guess the first step is I should just describe it for your listeners, that, you know, that they probably aren't aware of the fact that 100 years ago, you know, that Kansas isn't the boring place that's depicted in The Wizard of Oz, that in fact it's a, you know, And it's not the really bloodthirsty place depicted in Gunsmoke either, but it's it's a very, you know, it's a pretty wild and woolly place. And 100 years ago, it was the sort of epicenter of the populist movement, which was a radical working class movement, an alliance with farmers and workers, and they sort of swept the state. And Kansas has always had a tendency. Well, they swept a lot of areas, the South as well. And if we want to go back to the issue of race, there's the history of the populist vis-a-vis race is a very fascinating one, because that's when it was after populism that all the Jim Crow laws were passed in the South. But that's a different story. But Kansas and a lot of Midwestern states have always had this tendency to go for, they've had an affinity for radical movements. Up into the 1930s, the state, you know, you give them half a chance and they'll go for, you put a radical candidate on the ballot and they'll vote for the guy. And, you know, Eugene Debs was there for a while, and they had published, there was a socialist newspaper published out of Kansas that the Appeal to Reason had this enormous circulation 100 years ago. But this was the story all across the Midwest. And today we think of it as the warm and fuzzy Norman Rockwell heartland where nothing ever happens and life is very boring. And it has moved progressively, you know, further and further to the right. Just in my own lifetime, it's not recognizable anymore. And Kansas is the story there goes like this. It's always been, with the exception of the populist period, a Republican one-party state. But some of the Republicans there were pretty liberal, like William Allen White. Even Alf Landon, who came from there, was fairly liberal by the National Party standards. Then in the early 1990s, what happened was, and this is kind of a sad story, but Operation Rescue, Kansas is also a very religious state, I should mention, and Operation Rescue descended upon Wichita with tens of thousands of activists in the summer of 1991. The idea was to shut down the whole city, or to try to shut down the whole city, and you know, in order to shut down its abortion clinics. And they were partially successful, and more activists showed up, and they wound up staying the whole summer. They called it the Summer of Mercy. And lo and behold, while all the newspapers in the state deplored what was going on in Wichita, they couldn't believe this was happening, and this is the worst thing ever, these people wound up, the local conservatives wound up, you know, signing these people up, the activists, signing them up for the Republican Party and taking over the Republican Party from the bottom up. And what you saw in the years after that was a kind of, it was like the populist movement in the 1890s. It was this grassroots, well, let me back up and say, all these years I've been editing a sort of cultural magazine, and I've always been waiting to see a groundswell working class movement that throws out the slick old politicians and takes affairs into its own hands, you know, and does things like they used to do. And lo and behold, here it was happening in my own home state. And, you know, following this script, of 100 years ago, only it was they were right-wingers. These people were just moving further and further and further to the right. And so you see cases now like the city of Wichita, very blue-collar city. It's a city that I love, by the way. It's a great kind of place. If you want to study working-class culture, it's the kind of city where, you know, an election for the state legislature will have a pipe fitter going up against a maintenance man at Boeing or something like that. It's a great, great city. Their newspaper there, actually on Labor Day, used to run stories about the Haymarket Martyrs, which I don't believe any other newspaper in America, you know, would do something like that. But it's a very working-class town. Used to have a Democratic congressman, a Democratic mayor. Today, it has a right-wing Republican congressman and a right-wing Republican mayor, and is moving to the right with every election.
How's your book doing out there?
You know, it's a funny thing. It's the book is selling very well in Kansas, and I recently went back there. I was in Wichita a weekend before last. For a big spoke at the big machinist union hall. These are machinists that work at Boeing. And a lot of whom I interviewed, and they, by the way, they tend to have not fall union people, as this is the case everywhere in the country, tend to not fall for this stuff. They are they remain true to the liberal cause.
And I mean, I think one of the real issues is that we see a move to the right because we also see such a massive deunionization.
That's exactly right. Yes.
And I think when working people did have associations where many of these issues were talked about. I mean, you mentioned the example of the UAW and how it was able to counteract Wallace. I mean, I've just seen that over and over again historically, that the unions really have moved the working class vote in a more progressive tradition.
And oftentimes it doesn't really require a lot of intervention on the part of the union hierarchy or the leadership. It's just being in a union changes the way a person looks at things, because they have control over their own over a part of their life that most people don't have control over. And so, you know, I'd interview these union members in Wichita, and they'd say, "Well, yeah, you know, I'm against abortion, but these other issues are frankly are more important to me." Or, you know, I'm worried about my rights as a gun owner, but I'm more worried about the privatization of Social Security.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there, unfortunately, and you're going to have to get a copy of What's the Matter with Kansas, How Conservatives Won the Heart of America, an extraordinarily good reading activity by Thomas Frank and Mike Zweig. What are we going to read as a companion to that?
Well, What's Class Got to Do with It? American Society in the 21st Century, just out from Cornell University Press, and The Working Class Majority, which has been around for a couple of years and is...
Oh, I've got that book. That's a good one.
Well, thank you, Tom.
And Dorothy Sue Cobble, your book?
Yes, you can read my first book on waitress moms, Dishing It Out.
Excellent choice.
Or my most recent book, The Other Women's Movement, Workplace Justice and Social Rights in Modern America.
Well, you see, the Mutual Admiration Society in reading here is because, you know, something, I don't know, there is a kind of embryonic burgeoning movement here that maybe can recapture
so.
Kansas and the rest
of the
country.
The Democratic Party would listen.
Well, Thomas Frank, Dorothy Sue Cobble.
We got to make them listen.
Michael Zweig.
Shake the halls of power with more power.
Y'all have to come back. It's been great speaking with you, and we're going to give a little bit of time to the hordes that seem to be coming in from that billionaires from Bush group, who are obviously very incensed by the conversation we've been having. Thank you for joining us, Michael Zweig.
Thank you.
Thomas Frank.
Sure thing.
Dorothy Sue Cobble.
Now it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
Give a small child a knife, and the poor tyke is likely to chop off a finger. But in the hands of a master chef, that knife is a tool for creating a sumptuous feast. It's the same thing with money. Give money to poor people, and they'll probably squander it on foolish indulgences like aluminum siding or medicine or food. But if you put money in our hands, in the hands of people who have been around money all our lives, we're going to build empires and buy elections and develop weapon systems and suppress dissent and spread the blessing that is the essence of what America is all about. Unbridled corporate freedom all over the world. I'm Zena Fogue for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Pick up the billionaire!
Billionaires for Bush. We have those radio ads available online at billionairesforbush.com. And I've brought in a few of my friends from the Bling Bling Ka-Ching Singers. This is Uma D. Consuma and Ivy League Legacy. And Noah, No Accountability.
Hello.
And they're going to sing you a song. Noah, which song will you be singing?
Well, we're going to be singing a tribute to our man W. It's called Georgie Made the Size of My Wallet Grow.
Oh, wait a minute. How do you spell W?
W. Well,
W spells profits, I can tell you that.
Okay.
Exactly. And all, I think I must say, all this talk of unions and fair wages is making my money clips shiver.
Georgie made the size of my wallet grow. He fed the flow with lots of dough. Suddenly we're loving the status quo. Now the George Bush runs this town.
He's given us a reason to celebrate. He's filling us with pride. The gulf between the workers and the
grow. He fed the flow with lots of dough.
how Georgie is a champion of policy. They benefit the top 1%. But when it's time for funding the safety net, the budget's all been spent.
Georgie made the size of my wallet grow. He fed the floor with lots of dough. Suddenly we're loving the status quo. Now that George Bush runs this town.
Disgusting.
Yes,
that
yes.
was disgusting. But okay, you have good voices, and it was a good musical track, but the sentiment was absolutely repulsive. This is Labor Day, you know.
Cheap Labor Day. And you can find more of that sentiment on our new CD, Billionaires Are in the House, at our website, billionairesforbush.com, which helps us raise money so we can remind voters all across America just how good it's been for so few at the expense of so many.
I can't help but ask. Got another one?
I think we do.
Glutton for punishment.
Yes.
I mean, it is vulgar. It is disgusting. And if you could just visualize the way these people look, all of their couture outfits are made by child labor. The bling bling is outrageous. And
you know,
it is really perverse.
I'd just like to add that we use child labor because the little fingers are so good at the tiny stitch work.
Yes, I am the CEO of Little Fingers Incorporated, as a matter of fact. They are never too young to work for us, as we like to say, and we like to keep good, hardworking children off the streets of third world countries.
What, you know, since we have said that we have a new policy where we are giving the upper crust, where we are giving this perverse elite equal time. Well, I guess the least we can do is give you another opportunity to present musically your rather vulgar message.
Well, hopefully before too long we'll actually have taken over this station, and then once it becomes a Clear Channel station, we'll be able to play our music all the time. Don't have to worry about
it. It's a very sensitive issue.
Huzzah. Would you like to sing one more song from our new CD, Billionaires Are in the House, which is available online at billionairesforbush.com, as well as our new book, Billionaires for Bush, How to Rule the World for Fun and Profit, the tips, tricks, and trade secrets of not only how we do it, but how we keep doing it to you, America, the wealthiest 1%, celebrating the last 3 years at your expense. And we are all over the country, 76 chapters, as a matter of fact, and growing. And the Bling Bling Ka-Ching Singers will sing another song. Noah, which song will you be singing?
Well, we're going to be singing about something that has been great for us these few years, especially recently. It's jobless recovery. And really, the thing is, there are jobs. It's just that, well, they're overseas in China. So if you're willing to relocate, I mean, there's plenty of jobs available.
We're also hiring in Iraq. We pay you a hell of a wage, but we don't expect you to live to earn it long enough to earn it.
Well, with that charming
note. We have I think the orchestra is ready.
How can it be wrong? Cutting health benefits, pensions, and pay is a way to make dividends soar. A worker who asks for an 8-hour day will be tossed on his ass out the door. It's a jobless recovery. Why pay a salary? We can outsource all the work that we need. It's a jobless recovery. Work got nothing to fear on this glorious day. Any job that's done here can be done far away. Downsizing workers just gives me the chills, and it helps with the old bottom line. Indian workers with tech support skills work for cheap and speak English just fine. It's a jobless recovery. Why pay a salary? We can outsource all the work that we need. It's a jobless recovery. Working for you and me, we will grow richer indeed. With George Bush in the lead, our future's guaranteed. Reclassify employees and reduce our overhead. Call them independent contractors instead. If fast food workers manufacture burgers, shakes, and fries, then jobs in manufacturing are on the rise. Oh, 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 oh. It's a jobless recovery, working for you and me.
Jobless recovery,
bringing prosperity.
Jobless recovery,
we will grow richer indeed. A future's guaranteed.
This has been a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.